White Network presents Hitler's Table Talk, Study Out. Reading and commentary on the after-dinner monologues delivered by Adolf Hitler from 1941 to 1944 and transcribed by AIDS.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Episode 5 of Adolf Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour. It is Thursday, April 3rd, 2014, and it is 7 p.m. Central Time. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Somehow I'm not coming across loud enough, but I think it's all right. It's getting better now. So, Ray, what do we have on the agenda tonight?
We've got some pretty interesting and you might say controversial statements that Hitler made in these monologues here that are going to prompt some thinking, that's for sure.
Well, that's right. We have some good stuff on the agenda tonight. And I checked out the timeline for the corresponding events during these periods of time. And so I found a little bit. So we're going to be starting at the night of 20th August, 1941. And on the 20th of August, according to one source, the German 250th Infantry Division, which was nicknamed Blue Division, that's the Spanish Blue Division. I think there's a more of a name to that organized. It has to be, but they call it the German 250th Infantry Division. But it consisted of Spanish volunteers, and it was formed and began to move to Poland. This is supposed to be in August. Where are we? August 20th. Now that was formed when, because Franco, who wouldn't do what Hitler wanted him to do and wouldn't fully cooperate, all he did was stay neutral, but he wouldn't do some other more helpful things for the Germans. And after the Germans had helped Franco so much in just a couple of years before, with their Spanish Civil War. But, you know, he was thinking about what was best for Spain, and that's what everybody was doing all along the line in this. They were like allies, but at the same time, then they were considering what was best for them. And everybody says, well, that's what a leader is supposed to do. He has to consider what's best for his own people. I guess so. You're right, but at the same time, hardly anybody went all out for the Germans. They ended up pulling back for one reason or another. But this Blue Division, I have looked into sometime in the past, and they were excellent. They were great fighters. They did a whole lot of good. And so, I mean, I was going to say that Franco encouraged this, I suppose, and sort of to make it up, they formed this division of really good Spanish fighters. And I think they stayed to the end, or at least as long as they were still all together there. And so that was that. And then so all that had been going on. And then on either the 20th or the 22nd, there's two different dates from different sources, they mentioned that the German forces closed in on Leningrad, and that the Nazis, or it said that the siege of Leningrad begins. And so that was a couple days later, but that was obviously going on at this time, although we don't hear any talk about it at all in the conversations here. And I just thought I'd say also, I'm taking a lot of time up here, but that earlier in August 1941, Finnish troops had received orders to Finnish troops were fighting with with the Germans, or anyway against the Soviets, mm-hmm. of coming down from the north and doing a lot of good. But they reached their goal, which they had set for themselves, which was the pre-Winter War border, or a little bit beyond that. But after they reached their goals, they halted their advance, and they would not move any further. And they were still, they then moved some troops to East Karelia. So they moved eastward somewhat, but they were about 160 kilometers northeast of Leningrad in Karelia, and otherwise that far, in the north. And they didn't, and for 3 years, it said, I read, the Finns did little to contribute to the battle for Leningrad. So this Leningrad battle went on for 3 years, but they didn't do anything more about it. They just maintained their lines. So there again, you have that situation where they were taking care of themselves, and they didn't want to allow the Soviets to go any further into their territory. Mm-hmm. But it says that their headquarters rejected German pleas for aerial attacks against Leningrad, which I guess the Germans thought they could do. But they wouldn't do them, and they didn't advance further south from the Svir River, which they reached on 7th September. So that was a deal. I thought that was interesting, so I thought I'd mention it.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments on that?
Yeah, most definitely interesting. But to me, Carolyn, the most important thing you said there was Spanish division. And what that alludes to, and let's see, a long time ago, and I read that volunteers from over a dozen countries volunteered to fight with Germany in the Wehrmacht to try to hold back the Soviets. And your establishment historians and history classes do not like that talked about. They don't like to hear it. It's not in the books. Because the very idea that other nations would voluntarily go help Germany against Russia is, it doesn't fit their supposedly real history of Germany being the arch ultimate villain of mankind and out to crush everybody. And the fact that there was European cooperation to try to hold back that Soviet tide, I think that's the most important thing. And you mentioned there the Spanish divisions, of course.
Well, are you speaking about the Waffen-SS divisions that were formed from these various assorted nations, European nations?
Yes.
That were all volunteer? Well, I don't think this Spanish division was Waffen-SS. And the others were SS. They weren't Wehrmacht. I think that is a distinction there. But otherwise, it's absolutely right that that there were all those divisions. I don't know if there'll be anything about that in here, but it might come up.
Yeah, hopefully.
In the timeline. But sure. I have never read a whole lot about those Waffen-SS divisions. I'm aware of them, but I have read some on this Spanish Blue Division, which was supposed to have been really very good and did a lot of good.
Sure.
Well, okay, you're going to read. You're going to start reading.
Okay, we'll get started with this night of 19th and 20th of August, 1941. For the good of the German people, we must wish for a war every 15 or 20 years. An army whose sole purpose is to preserve peace leads only to playing at soldiers. Compare Sweden and Switzerland, or else it constitutes a revolutionary danger to its own country. If I'm reproached with having sacrificed 100 or 2,000 men by reason of the war, I can answer that, thanks to what I have done, the German nation has gained, up to the present, more than 2,500,000 human beings. If I demand a tenth of this as a sacrifice, nevertheless, I have given 90%. I hope that in 10 years there will be from 10 to 15 million more of us Germans in the world. Whether they are men or women, it matters little. I am creating conditions favorable to growth. Many great men were the sixth or seventh children of their family. When such and such a man, whom one knows, dies, one knows what one has lost. But does one know what one loses by the limitation of births? The man killed before he is born, that remains the enigma. Wars drive the people to proliferation. They teach us not to fall in the error of being content with a single child in each family. It's not tolerable that the life of the peoples of the continent should depend upon England. The Ukraine and then the Volga Basin will one day be the granaries of Europe. We shall reap much more than what actually grows from the soil. It must not be forgotten that from the time of the Tsars, Russia, with her 170 million people, has never suffered from famine. We shall also keep Europe supplied with iron. If one day Sweden declines to supply any more iron, that's all right, we'll get it from Russia. The industry of Belgium will be able to exchange its products, cheap articles of current consumption, against the grain from those parts. As for the poor working class families of Thuringia and the Harz Mountains, for example, they'll find vast possibilities there. In the regions we occupy in the Ukraine, the population is crowding into the churches. I'd see no harm in that if, as is the case at present, the masses were held by old Russian peasants. It would be different if they had priests. And as for those, we shall have to deliberate whether to let them come back. According to a report I've been reading, the Russian opposition thinks it can use the clergy as a base of departure for pan-Slav activities.
Okay. Well, do you want to comment on anything there before I start in?
Go right ahead.
No, you go ahead if you got something.
Well, what, he's talking about the need for an explosion in the German population being very important to its survival. He's also mentioning the adverse effects that the church can have in helping to foment revolution. He mentions that and those 2 points there. And also the inference of a unified Europe, different nations reaping the benefits of trade with the others and having its good points and good products to exchange for others.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's so clear with this is that he's talking about several different things here. And, you know, it doesn't all go together like as if this is all he said, because obviously he was saying more, but the note taker was just taking down what he thought were the most important things said. So it kind of moves from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
And, people will take something like, for the good of the German people, we must wish for a war every 15 or 20 years, and just make something out of that, you know, like, mm-hmm. Wow, this guy, he was intending to be at war all the time. Well, what he was talking about was, as you said, that he's saying that during wartime, people realize that if they might lose a son, and nowadays would be a daughter, but then it was the sons, they want to have more. They want to have enough children so that if they lose some, they still have some. And that he thinks that's good because he was, wanting to get the German people to have larger families.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying that if he, even if a couple hundred thousand men die in wartime, by his policies, millions more have been born and therefore makes up for that. And that's just the way he looked at this.
Right.
And I've read things from him elsewhere that he talks about. He's mentioned that sometimes some of the most brilliant, children in a family were, here he says 6th or 7th, but were sometimes even the 11th or 12th or something. You never know. And mm-hmm. So he's very much against abortion. And the way he puts it makes you feel, makes you certainly agree with him.
Then, go ahead. Excuse me. As a soldier, with his own experience, he realized that wars are extremely dysgenic because the young men that would go off to war were the ablest, most fittest of the population. Mm-hmm. And if you just had one son, two sons, whatever, they're going to be half may be wiped out or more. And it's a setback for the entire nation. And I think that's another reason for stressing to have big families.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that I was thinking about there was the churches. Yeah, now people will take offense at this. Mm-hmm. He says the people, we'd be better off if we don't allow the priests to come back into the Ukraine to serve in the churches. I thought it was going quite well with the old Russian peasants doing it. And again, but you answered that very well, that, you know, he mentions Pan-Slav activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been having some discussion about that during the week. So that's why I noticed that quite a bit, that he doesn't want not just revolution, but he doesn't want them organizing,
mm-hmm.
For their own interests, because now there's a lot of unhappiness with in today's thinking of we all have to share, you know, we're all in this together, and mm-hmm. all white people, and we all need to think, you know, care about one another, and there's no boundaries and so on. But I don't fully agree with that, actually. Mm-hmm. And in any case, I'm basically in agreement with Hitler and his idea that there can only be one ruler in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're gonna, well, you know, we've had the other. We have all the individuality. You know, we've had all the individual nations, and all we're doing is being enslaved by one group of people or another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You were going to go on to the night of the 14th and 15th,
right.
But this is another timeline thing. On the 15th,
okay.
of September, it said that self-government of Estonia, headed by a certain person, Halmar Mai, is appointed by German military administration. So the Germans were in control of Estonia, and they appointed a so-called self-government leader, self-governments in quotes. It wasn't 100% self-government, but it was kind of like what they had in Czechoslovakia, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So they governed themselves, and they appointed someone to an Estonian to do that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not too important, but that's it.
Okay. The night of 14th, 15th September, 1941. The triumph of gangsterdom in 1918 can be explained. During 4 years of war, great gaps were formed amongst the best of us. And whilst we were at the front, criminality flourished at home. Death sentences were very rare. And in short, all that needed to be done was to open the gates to the prisons when it was necessary to find leaders for the revolutionary masses. I've ordered Himmler, in the event of there someday being reason to fear troubles back home, to liquidate everything he finds in the concentration camps. Thus, at the stroke of at a stroke, the revolution would be deprived of its leaders. The old Reich knew already how to act with firmness in the occupied areas. That's how attempts at sabotage to the railways in Belgium were punished by Count von der Goltz. He had all the villages burnt within a radius of several kilometers. After having had all the mayors shot, the men imprisoned, and the women and children evacuated. There were three or four acts of violence in all, and then nothing more happened. It's true that in 1918 the population adopted a hostile attitude toward German troops going up into the line. I remember a town mayor who urged us to continue on our way when we wanted to chastise some blighters who stuck out their tongues at us. The troops could easily have settled such incidents, but the lawyers always took the side of the population. I can't say how I hate that artificial notion of law. Nowadays, it's the same thing. During the campaign in Poland, the lawyers tried to blame the troops because the latter had shot 60 civilians in a region where wounded soldiers had been massacred. In such a case, a lawyer opens legal proceedings against X. His inquiry leads nowhere, of course, for nobody has ever seen anything. And if anybody knows the guilty man, he'll take good care not to inform against a member of the resistance. Lawyers cannot understand that in exceptional times, new laws become valid. I shall be interested to know whether they'll pass the death sentence on that madman who set fire in the Bremen. Deliberately, it said, from a liking for setting things alight. I've given instructions for the event of the man's not being condemned to death. He's to be shot immediately. The prosecutor usually demands the death penalty, but the judges, when in doubt, always find extenuating circumstances. Thus, when the law prescribes as penalty either death, imprisonment for life, penal servitude, or a term of imprisonment, it's usually the last of these penalties that they select. Nearly 2,000 people in Germany disappear every year without a trace, victims for the most part of maniacs and sadists. It's known that these latter are generally recidivists, but the lawyers take great care to inflict only very light penalties on them. And yet these subhuman creatures are the ferment that undermines the state. I make no distinction between them and the brutes who populate our Russian POW camps. The lawyers generally arrange to throw the responsibility for their mildness on the legislator. This time, we've opened the road for them to extreme harshness. Nevertheless, they pronounce sentences of imprisonment. Responsibility is what they fear, and courage is what they lack. The amazing thing is that those who do not wish to respect a country's laws should nevertheless be allowed to profit by the advantages of these laws. Wow, a lot said.
I say Hitler was, he believed in swift and stern punishment.
Exactly.
This last part here. And you know, when he talks about the lawyers, and the troops and so on, he thought for sure that the people know how to take care of things. You know, in general, the people who are in an area, they know who's the bad guys and who isn't, and they know how to take care of things. But the lawyers come in and bring in the law. And as he says, they almost always give the most, the lightest penalty available to them to these people. He's totally against that.
Sure. He sees that as the reason why the continuation for those crimes go on.
Well, yeah, that's right. And because he says, you know, once they took care of a few things real in a harsh way, they stopped happening.
That's exactly right.
But we're so soft, you know, we just can't stand. I was so indoctrinated from the general media and so on, and education and so on, that I always felt sorry for people. And I always, you know, I had that attitude, oh, well, you shouldn't hurt these people and shouldn't do this, shouldn't do that. In general now, our white people are way too much that way. And we need to get a lot tougher and harder than we are if we're ever going to get anywhere, win out. I really do believe that now. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry to see people being so soft.
Yep, me too.
Yeah, good for you.
It was the opposite for me, Carolyn. I brought up the way I was. Hitler's talking here about firm sentences and death penalty and things like this, that's what I was brought up on, that was the way to keep order in the country and the way to keep the people safe and keep criminality from triumphing, and was to be very harsh. And, so that's been a part of me and my makeup.
Well, and that's how people think of Texas, and Texas is constant. You were born and raised in Texas.
Right.
And Texas is constantly being used as an example of terrible behavior and lack of liberality. And now they're saying, I heard just the other day when I was in my car on the car radio that there was people were thinking that Texas might go blue or Democrat soon because of this, that, or the other thing. And that's just so sickening to me now.
That's right.
Because one thing why Texas is a great state and why people come here to live and so on. There was too many people coming here, but, it's because, you don't have all those, all that horrible stuff that goes on in those liberal states, in those blue states. And also the town that I live in, I appreciate it more and more all the time because it has a white government. Everything is run by whites here, and they don't tolerate. There's not that much would be going on, but if it ever starts going on, they don't tolerate these people, and so they don't come here to make trouble. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's just a quiet, a law-abiding place, and you have to appreciate the people who run it for that.
Right. Right.
I appreciate it very much. I'm glad. So I wouldn't move out of Texas anymore. I don't know where it would go, where I'd go, where it'd be as good as here.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back to some of these things here. I was going to mention about this Count Vondergoltz. As he said that he acted with firmness. He burnt the villages, and he had all the mayors shot and the men in prison. Well, this was in, I'd like to read more about him. This is World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was in Belgium, and there was attempts to, no, he says, he was commanding the German infantry division of guards on foot in France. And so I guess he had something to do there with Belgium. And then later he went to Latvia and Estonia, and he had a lot of success in Latvia. They got rid of they drove out the communists in Latvia, but in Estonia he didn't manage to succeed altogether. But obviously Hitler admired the way he did things. I won't go on anymore because you covered everything real well. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and read the 17th of September, 1941, okay. And also includes the night of 17th and 18th, that night. And in the timeline, it says that on the 19th, so that was a day later, the Germans captured Kiev. And on the 19th, it became formal. The Red Army forces had suffered many casualties in defending this chief city of the Soviet Ukraine. So that was a big success. So they were still, still having successes. This was only in the very beginning of the Barbarossa campaign here. It's only September. So Hitler says the spirit of decision does not mean acting at all costs. The spirit of decision consists simply in not hesitating when an inner conviction commands you to act. Last year, I needed great spiritual strength to take the decision to attack Bolshevism. I have to stop right here because I think this is so good. To make an important decision, it's very, very hard where so many lives are involved and so much, is at stake. And he is talking about not hesitating when an inner conviction commands you to act. And that is very difficult because inner convictions, I've had some experience with that, not on this kind of a scale, but I know how hard it is to follow an inner conviction because it's not like somebody's beating on the door of your brain or something. It's just subtle, I mean, it's just kind of, you don't have any kind of surety or anything. But this is how Hitler behaved so often. And he says he was his decision was to attack Bolshevism. I thought that was interesting because I realized that that's what he means by that is his decision to invade the Soviet Union.
True.
And he always said, that this was what we needed to defeat was Bolshevism.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't going after the Russian people, although he did want to have Ukraine mm-hmm. for all the grain fields and so on, which they needed. But he did feel that it was his duty to go after to destroy Bolshevism because it was trying to destroy Germany and all of Europe then. And he did feel that very strongly, I think. And that's so anyway, going on, he says, I had to foresee that Stalin might pass over to the attack in the course of 1941, meaning that he foresaw, he had to foresee that Stalin was going to attack in that year. You know, that's what he means there. It was therefore necessary to get started without delay in order not to be forestalled, and that wasn't possible before June. Even to make war, one must have luck on one side. When I think of it, what luck we did have. I couldn't start a campaign of propaganda to create a climate favorable for the reverse situation, and innumerable lives were saved by the fact that no newspaper or magazine article ever contained a word that could have let anyone guess what we were preparing. I decided to take into account the risk that in the ranks of the Wehrmacht there might still be some elements contaminated by communism. If there were, I suppose that those of them who could see what happens in Russia have now been cured. But at the moment of our attack, we were entering upon a totally unknown world, and there were many people amongst us who might have reflected that we had, after all, a pact of friendship with the Russians. Then he goes on into kind of something else here, related, but seems to be a little shift. The German soldier has again proved that he is the best soldier in the world. He was that in the time of Frederick the Great, and he has always been that. When it's a question of holding on, that's when he reveals his full effectiveness. On every level, every man does exactly what is expected of him. After the campaign in the West, people were still saying that the soldier of today hadn't the endurance of the infantryman of the First World War. Here, on the Eastern Front, he has proved that he has this endurance. At the time of the First World War, nobody paid attention to the soldier's individual value in combat. Everything was done en masse. During the period of the War of Movement in 1914, compact units were thrown into the battle. In the War of Position that followed, the posts were much too close together. Another mistake was to have as company commanders elderly men of 40 to 50. For infantry, physical agility is everything, so one must have young officers leading these units. The factor of surprise is half the battle. That's why one cannot go on repeating an operation indefinitely, simply because it has been successful. Antonescu is using in front of Odessa, the tactics of the First World War. Well, of course, I got to explain that Antonescu is the prime minister and a big general of Romania, and was collaborating with with Germany and Hitler, and Hitler was thought he was doing a very good job, and he was actually, you know, leading. He wasn't a politician at home; he was leading his forces, or at least directing things. And Hitler says about him, every day he advances a few kilometers after using his artillery to pulverize the space he wishes to occupy. As regards artillery, he has a crushing superiority over his opponent. In view of the circumstances of the terrain, it's obviously possible to set about things in this fashion. The operation now in progress, an encirclement with a radius of more than 1,000 kilometers, has been regarded by many as impracticable. I had to throw all my authority into the scale to force it through. I note in passing that a great part of our successes have originated in, quote, mistakes that we've had the audacity to commit. Then he says, the struggle for the hegemony of the world will be decided in favor of Europe by the possession of the Russian space. So now he's moved over to this, thinking now in terms of the importance of gaining this territory. Thus, Europe will be an impregnable fortress, safe from all threat of blockade. all this opens up economic vistas, which one may think will incline the most liberal of the Western Democrats towards the new order. The essential thing for the moment is to conquer. After that, everything will be simply a question of organization. When one contemplates this primitive world, he's speaking of Russia, so you know that. When one contemplates this primitive world, one is convinced that nothing will drag it out of its indolence unless one compels the people to work. The Slavs are a mass of born slaves who feel the need of a master. As far as we are concerned, we may think that the Bolsheviks did us a great service. They began by distributing the land to the peasants, and we know what a frightful famine resulted. So they were obliged, of course, to reestablish a sort of feudal regime to the benefit of the state. But there was this difference, that whereas the old-style landlord knew something about farming, the political commissar, on the other hand, was entirely ignorant of such matters. So the Russians were just beginning to give their commissars appropriate instruction. If the English were to be driven out of India, India would perish. Our role in Russia will be analogous to that of England in India. Even in Hungary, National Socialism could not be exported. In the mass, the Hungarian is as lazy as the Russian. He's by nature a man of the steppe. From this point of view, Horthy is right in thinking that if he abandoned the system of great estates, production would rapidly decline. It's the same in Spain. If the great domains disappeared there, famine would prevail. The German peasant is moved by a liking for progress. He thinks of his children. The Ukrainian peasant has no notion of duty. There is a peasantry comparable to ours in Holland and also in Italy, where every inch of ground is zealously exploited. Also, to a certain extent, in France. The Russian space is our India. Like the English, we shall rule this empire with a handful of men. It would be a mistake to claim to educate the native. All that we could give him would be a half knowledge, just what's needed to conduct a revolution, he's saying. Half knowledge to give them partial knowledge would just encourage them conducting revolutions against the Germans. So he says, It's not a mere chance that the inventor of anarchism was a Russian. Unless other peoples, beginning with the Vikings, had imported some rudiments of organization into Russian humanity, the Russians would still be living like rabbits. One cannot change rabbits into bees or ants. These insects have the faculty of living in a state of society, but rabbits haven't. If left to himself, the Slav, I don't know how, where this is going to end. If left to himself, the Slav would never, should I stop here? We should talk about what we've said so far.
Okay.
He's right in the middle of this Slav thing, but anyway, it's okay. I'll just add this last part here. Left to himself, the Slav would never have emerged from the narrowest of family communities. Okay, well, this is where you're going to get a lot of criticism. Mm-hmm. And I've already had somebody writing and saying, it wasn't about this, but it was the same kind of thing, that this is enough to make you want to kill Hitler over and over again. And he's not, as far as I know, this person is not Slavic. He calls himself an American. He's got an English name. And I've communicated with him before, and I never heard him say anything like that, but he seems to be kind of upset. So what do you have to say about all of this?
Well, very important where Hitler says, the spirit of decision consists simply in not hesitating when an inner conviction commands you to act. And he led right into perfect segue into his decision to launch Barbarossa. And had he waited on his military people to make that decision, Russia would have gotten the jump mm-hmm. on them and definitely gone on the attack. And, you know, I've heard over the years guys discussing this or people discussing this part, and they said, you know, oh, Hitler was dumb not to listen to his generals. He overrode them, and that's what cost Germany the war. Well, I think it was totally the opposite. And when Hitler, because he was a military man, he'd been through the war. He was a brilliant person, much more than just the common foot soldier that didn't really know what was going on. And then I was pleased that he put this, I note in passing that a great part of our successes have originated in mistakes that we've had the audacity to commit, meaning that he was being second-guessed an awful lot by some of his military men, and he knew that. But what could they say when the decisions he made turned out to be the right ones? And and then, you know, he also mentioned there, another mistake was to have his company commanders elderly men of 40 to 50. And he says there, for infantry, physical agility is everything. So one must have young officers leading these units. There's more to that than just physicality. I think these elderly men, he's talking about 40 to 50 years old leading your units, are going to fight by the tactics that they were taught, which may have applied decades before, but which were actually a drawback to modern combat. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So to me, that's kind of what you've covered there.
Yeah. Well, what about Russia being a primitive world?
Mm-hmm.
And that the people were the natural way of the people was indolence.
Mm-hmm.
You think he's way out of line there?
No, I don't. I think I took that to mean that as far as industrial advancement, technological advancement, the right methods of farming and things like this, the most productive output and things like this, that they were in a lot of ways the primitive stage. The fact that a huge slice of their population was illiterate, and just knew a day-to-day existence and things like this. And I think that that's why he alluded to this as a primitive thing.
Well, yeah, very, very well put. And it's very true. And it was the communists, it was Stalin, and that mm-hmm. who put forth this great effort to industrialize Russia, and did it with a lot of cruelty. It was tough as all get out. But he's given a lot of credit today for doing that, including by the Russians, you know, who are happy that they came out of that primitive state that they were in. But I think Hitler is also saying that if you remain in such a state without doing anything about it for so long, you know, when other nations, when in the West, you know, they're moving forward and making all kinds of advances, that he saw that as a different type of people, and
that's
he
right.
saw that throughout the East there, what we call, I guess, Eastern Europe, he made that observation, which you can't argue with.
No.
But we're in this I'm calling it a political correctness where we're not supposed to say things like this because people feel insulted.
Well,
and he even says here the Hungarian is as lazy as the Russian. And when he means lazy, he means they're just not motivated in the same way that Westerners are
right.
to improve
right.
things. And he says a man of the steppe. Now, you know, a man of the steppe can be quite a man, you know.
That's right.
And they ride horses and they do all this. And then they sit around and smoke and talk and with each other. And the women do the work and so on. I mean, they have a kind of a culture where they don't have to do all that much, and they just didn't. So that's how he uses lazy. And to him and to a German, it was lazy.
Well, that's correct. But I also think that when he talks about other nationalities like this, our nation, and says primitive in the sense of Russia and all, a lot of people want to take that in a manner that they're saying, okay, Hitler says the world can do without these people. Let's just exterminate them. Let's do without them. When in all he's been telling you all along is that everybody has their place. Everybody has their value to fit into the system and to help make it work. And those lowly farmers, you know, whatever, are absolutely necessary to the existence of a unity of a nation if you're going to put together something after this war is over. And he's not talking about when he calls them lazy or you know, worthless and whatever. He doesn't mean that they have no place. What he means is that the cream has to rise to the top. Those with initiative and leadership have to be there, but those that are at the bottom of the pyramid are of necessity too. But political correctness and establishment history says, no, you've got to read that as this man was a monster. He wanted to kill everybody but Germans.
Thought that they were subhuman.
I think we've already
read it, that he used the word subhuman for these criminals. Yeah, mm-hmm. I wanted to point that out. He was talking about the criminals, and then he said, but he doesn't see that these Soviet POWs were about the same, or he thought they were about the same.
Right, he compared them
So that might be, because he thought they were pretty brutish, but that might be that where some of those ideas come that he was calling the Russians subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but, you know, he wasn't actually, you know, how, and of course we have to remember he's here talking to his own people, some of his most intimate people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's just saying whatever he thinks. He's not, you know, I mean, he thinks it, but he's not trying to make it nice for the public.
Right.
Although he supposedly knew he was being recorded, you know, mm-hmm. someone was taking notes, but he probably thought that would be taken care of or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'll go ahead and finish reading this, and then you can read the next one. The Germanic race created the notion of the state. Okay, first he said anarchism was invented by a Russian,
mm-hmm.
and now he says the Germanic race created the notion of the state. It incarnated this notion in reality by compelling the individual to be a part of a whole. It's our duty continually to arouse the forces that slumber in our people's blood. I like that. Everybody should think that way.
Mm-hmm.
The Slav people are not destined to live a cleanly life. Here he goes again. They know it, and we would be wrong to persuade them of the contrary. It was we who in 1918 created the Baltic countries and the Ukraine. I have to look into that. That's me saying that. I want to know exactly what he means by that. But nowadays, he says, we have no interest in maintaining Baltic states any more than in creating an independent Ukraine. We must likewise prevent them from returning to Christianity. That would be a grave fault, for it would be giving them a form of organization. I am not a partisan either of a university at Kiev. It's better not to teach them to read. Boy, this is really tons of stuff for people to get upset about. They won't love us for tormenting them with schools. Even to give them a locomotive to drive would be a mistake. And what stupidity it would be on our part to proceed with the distribution of land. Now, these people in Ukraine were, they lived very poorly. You know, they were just grubbing peasants living in their huts and so on. They really were not any, you know, they really were in a bad shape. Not that it was fair, but that's the way it was. And it wasn't the Germans who caused it, but, anyway, so he's saying, I feel the need to explain, I guess. He's saying, it would be stupidity to, proceed with the distribution of land for the Ukrainian peasants. In spite of that, we'll see to it that the natives live better than they've lived hitherto. We'll find amongst them the human material that's indispensable for tilling the soil. We'll supply grain to all in Europe who need it. The Crimea will give us its citrus fruits, cotton, and rubber. 100,000 acres of plantation would be enough to ensure our independence. The Pripet marshes will keep us supplied with reeds. I don't know what they needed reeds for, but we'll supply the Ukrainians with scarves, glass beads, and everything that colonial peoples like. The Germans, this is essential, will have to constitute among themselves a closed society, like a fortress. The least of our stable lads must be superior to any native. For German youth, this will be a magnificent field of experiment. We'll attract the Ukrainian Danes, Dutch, Norwegians, Swedes. The army will find areas for maneuvers there, and our aviation will have the space it needs. Let's avoid repeating the mistakes committed in the colonies before 1914. Apart from the colonial Gesellschaft, which, or the colonial society, which represented the interests of the state, only the silver interests had any chance of raising their heads there. The Germans must acquire the feeling of the great open spaces. We must arrange things so that every German can realize for himself what they mean. We'll take them on trips to the Crimea and the Caucasus. There's a big difference between seeing these countries on the map and actually having visited them. The railways will serve for the transport of goods, but the roads are what will open the country for us. Today, everybody is dreaming of a world peace conference. For my part, UN and all that stuff. For my part, I prefer to wage war for another 10 years rather than be cheated thus of the spoils of victory. In any case, my demands are not exorbitant. I'm only interested, when all is said, in the territories where Germans have lived before. The German people will raise itself to the level of this empire. That's that. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say, Ray?
Well, I figured one of the statements that you read there that is going to turn some people's head attention-wise, when he says we must likewise prevent them from returning to Christianity. He's talking about the nations that have fallen behind the Soviet curtain, so to speak, and Bolshevism rules there. It would be a grave fault, for it would be giving them a form of organization. Anyway, and it's better not to teach the people to read. Certain people will see to it that the natives live better than they've lived hitherto. That kind of reminds me of something I heard back in high school from a teacher that I respected above all others. He taught Texas history, government, and he was a Marine veteran of World War II. But at that time, Castro had just taken over Cuba from Batista and had instituted a lot of laws, reform, things like this, and I remember asking him one day in class, how is it that the Cuban people have not rose up against Castro now that everybody knows he's communist and things like this? And he said, well, the Cuban peasantry under Batista was like, let's say, taking a whipping every day at the whipping post, whereas under Castro, they get a slap in the face and then they're left alone, meaning – meaning that they don't have the best of anything, but they've got it a whole lot better under Castro's communism than they had it under Batista's abuse. So I kind of thought of that when I saw this right here. You know, when he's talking initially, it's like negative. We don't want to teach them to read. We want to keep them from returning to Christianity, but we will see to it that these natives live better than they've lived before. And,
I think he's just saying that, that these people are going to be peasants. They're going to be working the land and they should be satisfied with that. And if you teach people too much and send them, let them go to schooling, a lot of schooling and university, then they're going to have other ideas. They want to, move up. And he doesn't want these people to move up because he wanted, Germans to be the elite here. And these people would remain as they were, although they would live better than they had been living. But why change anything like that?
Right.
It's not like punishment, but the words he uses and the way he says it, although he's not trying to be politically correct about it, he's just talking to his people there,
Right.
And it just, Well, we're not used to talking like this. We think you shouldn't ever say anything like this. I mean, he says the Slav people are not destined to live a cleanly life. Well, you know, Germans, the Germanic people are super clean. Mm-hmm. And cleanliness is a part of the whole German structure and even National Socialist structure. Mm-hmm. And they mean a lot of things by it. But they did not think that the people, the Slavic people, were clean compared to the way they were clean.
Right.
And they weren't. They weren't.
That's
they
right.
aren't. Maybe now things have changed, but still probably not quite exactly the same. I won't go into that, so we don't have too much time left.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We can probably cover this last one before the buzzer goes off on us, Carolyn. It's 21st of September.
Oh, you think so? Oh, is it real short?
It's short, yeah.
Well, go ahead. All right.
Okay. The Czechs are the people who will be most upset by the decline of Bolshevism, for it's they who have always looked with secret hope towards Mother Russia. When we learnt of the fall of Port Arthur, the little Czechs in my class at school wept, while the rest of us were exalted. It was then that my feeling for Japan was born. It would have been the duty of the Hohenzollerns to sacrifice the Habsburg monarchy to Russian aspirations in the Balkans. A dynasty's domination ceases to be justified when its ambitions are no longer adjusted to the nation's permanent interests. Once a dynasty adopts the safeguarding of peace at any price and the maintenance of undue consideration for the feelings of other foreign dynasties as its guiding principles, it is doomed. That's why I'm grateful to social democracy for having swept away all these royalties. Even supposing it had been indispensable, I don't know whether any of us would have so definitely set himself against the House of Hohenzollern. Against the Habsburgs, yes. In my eyes, it was a foreign dynasty. The injustice committed by the Kaiser at Bismarck's expense finally recoiled upon him. How could the Kaiser demand loyalty from his subjects when he had treated the founder of the Reich with such ingratitude? The shameful thing is that the German people allowed such an injustice to be committed. The generation of 1900 was lost economically, politically, and culturally. The men of the nationalist opposition exhausted themselves in being right. When one has preached in the desert for decades, it proves that when the time comes for action that one has lost all contact with reality. These Germans of the old school were fine fellows, but their specialty was literature. Their audience was 20,000 readers of their own stamp. None of them knew how to speak to the people. Right from the beginning, I realized that one could not go far along that track. The man who means to act must find his support in faith, and faith is found only in the people. The great masses have no mercy. They go straight ahead with the simplicity of innocence. We have seen what a people is capable of when it's led. All possibilities exist in it for good as well as for evil. The duty of National Socialism inevitably boils down to this. All that is best in the people should be allowed ceaselessly to develop. And
that's great. You know, we've only got less than 60 seconds now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that's very, I would like to discuss
yeah.
a little bit in there.
Right.
But we can do that. We can probably do that next week. But
okay.
this, the duty of National Socialism boils down to, developing your people to the highest they can be. And he was so steeped in that when he looked around at, like we say, at these Slavic nations, he just didn't have a good opinion of them at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to put that all into context. And I do think that it's known that he hated the Habsburgs. You know.
Yep.
Well, okay. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn saying good night, and
good night from Ray.
All right. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour will return next week. Exclusively on the White Network.